So, why'd you go to poetry?
Well, I kind of went to poetry, not accidentally, but not knowing. My story is kind of different, probably, than some of the people, or many of the people you've talked to. Here's what I remember. When I was, like, seven, I would scribble things down in my school books, you know, and on the big line paper and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to give the impression this was like I was a child prodigy and this was genius stuff. I mean, I had no idea. Let me go back just a bit too, because I come from a working class family. That's where that anthology comes out of, that experience and then my teaching experience. But I come from a working class anthology, a working class family. And, education in the working class family is respected, and it's good, it's a good thing, but it's not the top priority. The top priority for old school working class is that you grow up and get a job, and, you know, you provide for your family. And so that's kind of the aesthetic I was raised in, and it doesn't put necessarily a lot of emphasis on, you know, academic or intellectual stuff. So, like, for example, in our house, my grandmother, I was raised by my grandparents, my grandmother and grandfather, they never read poetry. And, I mean, I didn't even think to ever ask them that, but they probably couldn't tell you a poet, really. Mm-hmm. Not even, like, you know, Whitman or something. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't a thing. However, my grandmother, who was actually, in hindsight, pretty young for a grandmother. She, meaning she was in, like, 41 or something like that. Yeah. And at the time, I mean, you know, I thought she was a grandmother, but she was 41. And she really liked Elvis Presley. And so I was listening to Elvis Presley at the age of four on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And she bought me Elvis's Golden Hits record. And I played it and played it and played it, and Grandma loved it. We'd go to the movies and see the Elvis movies and stuff like that. So that kind of culture, you know, was big. Other than, you know, the Wonderful World of Disney on Sunday nights too, that kind of thing. And of course Ed Sullivan. But so that was kind of in the background. Now, when I'm in the second grade, I start scribbling stuff. I don't know, it's kind of, you know, you guys know being poets and writers, how it's in there, you can't do anything about it. But I had no idea, you know. And I would get in trouble for it. You know, they would call my grandmother and say, you know, he scribbled some stuff, and we don't know what it is, but, you know, he scribbled, and so you pay for the book or whatever. that kind of thing, I remember that part.
So you're scribbling in books?
In the books and on anything.
Okay.
But not, having no clue. I know this sounds bizarre, but it's the truth. When I got to the fifth grade, I was doing this all the time, and scribbling and paper and so on and so forth, and notebooks. When I got to the fifth grade, I remember having a big textbook, an English textbook that had a pelican like on a post in the ocean or something. And when I opened that book, I noticed that it had things in it that had a lot of white space around it. And when I saw that, I thought, well, that's kind of what I'm scribbling. What I'm scribbling isn't sentences. It has a lot of white space around it. So at that point, that's when I first was able to say, oh, it's a poem. Maybe I saw The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe in that book or something. And I just saw it, and I thought, well, that must be what I'm doing. So it's a poem. Now, what's that? I don't know what that is. You know, I didn't read poems. And in fact, you know, you guys probably say poem. You know, in Detroit, we say poems. And maybe you already noticed that, but at any rate, so at that point I knew that's what I was doing, so at least I had a reference, and I kept doing that. And remember too, at the fifth grade, when I was in fifth grade, this was the beginning of the shift in our culture, because Kennedy's assassinated. Shortly after, and I'm already a music devotee, but early Elvis was really exciting to me, and then that, when they kind of wanted to soften Elvis's image, That's when like the Bobby Rydells and, you know, the Fabians and people like that came out. That was kind of boring to me. I didn't think that was very. I did like Dion's Ruby. But other, you know, most of the Hey Paula and stuff like that, it was goofy. And so I was, you know, I have a story about this that I wrote later, but I was really waiting, you know, into wanting something different. And right at that moment, then the Beatles come. So that was really an eye-opener, too. Now, Grandma wasn't necessarily a Beatle devotee at first or initially. I mean, she didn't care one way or the other, but this opened my eyes to a lot of things. And as I've said before, when we watched him on the Ed Sullivan Show, which everybody here but Tim and probably you didn't. Did you see him?
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. No, you're too young.
She looks younger than she is.
5 years older than you ever come.
Really?
From what I just figured out.
Oh, okay. when I saw them, this is true, again, I mean, now it all sounds like a fairy tale, I guess, but I saw them on the black and white television screen, and you remember when they first came on, people didn't know who was who.
Yeah.
They heard there was like a John. What everybody did remember is there was a guy named Ringo, because that was so unusual. Yeah. In fact, I tell my students, because I teach the Beatles now, I tell my students that back in those early days, you know, Ringo was the most popular Beatle, and they're kind of like, really? And it was like, probably because he looked a little different, and his name was Ringo, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I watched them, and if you remember that first one, they put their names by them. And, as you know, to tell people who's who. And when I saw the guy on the right side of the screen, I looked at him and I said, I was really digging it, and I said, I don't know who that guy is. But whoever he is, I want some of that. I want to understand that. And it turned out it was John Lennon.
Whoa.
So, and then they said John Lennon, and remember, sorry girls, he's married, and you know that kind of little thing on the Ed Sullivan thing. So he just, you know, stuck out to me, even in those initial few minutes of seeing them, because that was the first time we saw them, you know, actually. So at any rate, now I know I'm doing poetry, I'm into the Beatles heavy, I'm into the whole British invasion thing, and the two things are running parallel for me. So now I'm getting my education, essentially, from the Beatles. As they, you know, move through different phases and they mention and reference different things in their songs and their songs become more sophisticated, I'm kind of studying that. I'm not really a bookworm kind of guy, but I was studying that stuff. I mean, as time went on, they would, you know, even later mention Chairman Mao. I'm at the library. What's that? They would mention communism or something. What's that? Back in the USSR. What's USSR? What's that? So I was really kind of growing intellectually along with that, and knowing I was writing poetry. So by the time I get into junior high school, I know that's what I'm doing. And again, it's not good, but I'm kind of reflecting in some kind of primitive poetry. And I saved everything. I've never looked at it. I put it in boxes and duct taped it. And I don't want to see it, especially now. But I saved everything. I never threw anything out. And I tell my students that. Never throw anything out. So at any rate, that's what I was probably, and I know I was, writing about you know, kind of popular cultural things, the music, the civil rights movement, that was on my radar. Not even being working class, because, you know, whatever you are, you don't necessarily think that's what you are. You don't know what you are until later in hindsight, you know. I mean, I knew at the time where we lived in St. Clair Shores, at the time we moved there, it was mostly a white-collar community. I know most dads kind of looked like Fred McMurray going to work, or Ozzie Nelson. You know, they all had ties, which was very unusual, you know. And my, you know, grandfather got in an old beat-up jalopy and drove to the plant, you know, early in the morning with a lunch bucket. I remember that. And I have a newer poem about that, too, as a matter of fact. But it's going to be the title of the next book. But at any rate, so I'm starting to write about this, and now when I'm in 1965, I guess you can do the math, December of 1965, two doors down, the neighbor boy, who was a high school student and our newspaper boy, Well, he, you know, and I, this is hindsight, but, you know, his dad was a Marine, so as soon as he graduated high school, he signed up for the Marines. Well, he was killed in Vietnam. December, I think, 10th of 65. And everybody knew the kid, you know, and it was like, wow, what's that, and what's Vietnam? What is that? And I was very close to my grandmother, and his mother really never recovered from that, and I observed that. And then she died a couple of years later, and you know the word on the, in the neighborhood was that she died of a broken heart, and this just stayed with me. So now I know it. I'm investigating Vietnam, and of course it's escalating, and the culture's changing, and the music's changing, and all that stuff. And I know I'm writing more as I move towards the latter part of my junior high experience. I'm moving towards writing politically, kind of charged poetry. And I'm becoming very political as a young kid. And that, you'll see evidence of that as I kind of move to graduation and so forth. I mean, I become very interested in politics, especially the countercultural stuff of like the Students for a Democratic Society. This was making sense to me. I know I went, and I did go to protest against the war in Vietnam. There happened to be in our neck of the woods a tank arsenal, and there were always protests there that were being led by the SDS and other, you know, groups like that. And I actually would go to them. I couldn't really get my other high school friends to go. They thought I was kind of crazy. You know, I thought, well, you know, we're all kind of into this culture, we're listening to this music, you know, we're participating in so many levels with it. Why don't you get that part of it, too? And they just didn't. In fact, I remember some of those guys at the time as you know, called me a radical bunny rabbit. I'm not sure what that meant, but you know, I'd always say, come on, they're having a, you know, like the war moratorium in 69, you know, come on, we got to wear these bands, and, you know, like I did, nobody else did, you know, and then the teachers are like, what's wrong with you, you know, and that kind of stuff. Some of them, whom I'm still friends with, one guy, you know, was a young teacher then, and he became very interested and would talk to me quite a bit. He would prod me, you know, he was a young teacher, probably that time he was like 24 or something, and he would ask, you know, he'd kind of taunt me a little bit by questioning my mind about these issues of the Vietnam War and civil rights and the moratorium, and you know, it was kind of good, it was good for me, and he was a good teacher. So, and also, so I'm writing these poems, I'm still doing that, now I know I'm a poet, whatever that is, I know that's what I'm doing. So I also then get interested in, I probably in a subtle way in my mind, making the transition, I start writing for the school newspaper. And I start doing the rock and roll column, and I do political opinion stuff. Yeah. And for the Times, I'm not saying it's sophisticated, but about the war and other stuff. I did write an article about this program that was a community program. You guys probably, well, they had one in San Francisco. I don't remember what it was called out there. It might have been called Open City. But we had, or that was where teens could call about drugs and, you know, other problems that teens had, you know, sexually spread diseases and stuff. And it was, you know, anything. You could call about anything. And they were going to start one in our neighborhood, more or less, in the suburbs. And it was called Ozone. And I forget what it stood for. Now, so you know, I wrote about that, and I compared it to this Open City thing. Well, the John Birch Society, which was around then, now we call them the Tea Party. that you can keep in the interview. But that's what they were. The Tea Party is the John Birch Society. Well, one kid in my class, his mother and dad were part of the John Birch Society. And he must have gone home with the newspaper and showed it to him. And so they were making, our school, public schools are supporting the decadence of Open City, sex, drugs, you know. And this guy is at the center of it because he wrote this editorial.
Meaning you.
Me. So I started getting these threats at home, you know, because back in those days our phone numbers were listed and stuff. Mine ain't anymore, but back in those days, you know, everybody was.
Yeah, sure.
And so, I mean, we even had party lines, as you probably remember, but at any rate, I would get these calls about, stop writing that stuff, you know, we're going to get you. And then they started making hay in the public school system. And this one, and I just referenced the guy last night at the performance, Gordy Dressel, because he was on the council, city council, at Beyond Baroque. We did the gig, and an old high school friend was there. And he came to my support. And then there was this older priest. I wasn't Catholic then. I've converted to Catholicism, not because of this, but this older, respected Catholic priest in St. Clair Shores, he also spoke out on my behalf. And after they became, it became a news article, and then they became public with it, it just kind of petered out and went away. Now, so I'm writing that. For my high school thing, most kids go to Florida. I don't know where they go here, maybe Alaska or something, I don't know. But I went to New York, and that was a real eye-opening experience. I was 17. We get in New York. We're there for a couple of weeks. I get to go to the Fillmore East, which was a dream, and see all of this stuff. And I remember, you know, I was writing about it, and I was a poet, and I knew that, and that was the way that was going to go. So I still continued running a parallel with poetry and politics. So as soon as I turned 18, that was the first year 18-year-olds could vote, I ran for a precinct delegate. Actually, that was another weird story. They came through the community college and passed out a survey. And, you know, it was various things like, who do you want for president? Who would you support? And I don't know, I put Abby Hoffman, Vice President Jerry Rubin. Well, whatever, you know. And so the people that did these surveys from, like, whatever, the Student Democratic Council or something, they immediately call me. And so you got to run for precinct delegate. Now, remember, I'm kind of anti-establishment just by nature. So running for Democratic precinct delegate, I mean, that would be like giving in to the man. But I waited out, and then they talked me into it, and I was supporting McGovern. And we did a clever thing where we disguised it. We said I was uncommitted, but I was really committed to McGovern. Somebody else was committed to Wallace, you know, so they were out. And I won sort of by default by this large number of votes and stuff. So then I became involved in party politics at that time and continued that role, going to the conventions and things like that. Took, of course, the loss of McGovern's presidency very hard, you know, very hard. A couple of years after that, again now from this working class family, I'm working at Sears in Roebuck as a janitor. And we decide to organize, to bring a union into Sears. I mean, in hindsight, this is insane, but at the time, it seemed like we could do this, you know. And, but we weren't kowtowing to the union. We had some fights with them, but anyway, the election was set, and we got the ballot signed and so forth. And the company, of course, they were pushing on the people that worked there not to vote for you. In the end, it was something like, you know, 300 employees voted against it and like 6 for it. It was really bad. I took that really hard. But that was a time too, though, my grandfather understood. Because he was part of the, I was just telling Linda, part of the 1937 sit-down strike at Dodge, Maine. So I remember my grandmother saying, you know, I should also mention this. My grandmother always thought that if I could get a job at Sears, which she loved, which she thought was the greatest store in the world, if I could get a job at Sears, I'd be set. You know, that's, you know, college, I don't even think they knew what college was. Now, I was going to it, and they knew it, but I don't think they understood what that was. But Sears, and also they always would say, they'd throw Uncle Andy into the equation. And Uncle Andy had worked his way up from being a garbage slinger to like the crew chief in Detroit, the garbage man. So they said, if you can end up like Uncle Andy, you're going to be set for life, you know. Sears, even better. That's a step up the working class ladder. Well, I worked at Sears. So my grandmother was like, oh, I don't know if you should jeopardize, you know, that job at Sears. And, you know, my grandfather, I remember him distinctly saying, like, this is serious business. That was the first time, because he was really not an activist or anything. He was part of the 37 sit-down, but only because he believed that was right. Not, he wasn't the leader of it or anything. He was just there with 10,000 other men, you know, participating in that. So that's you know, part of when things, now I'm in, I just start college at this point too. And I know I'm going to be a poet. I'm writing poetry. I get into a creative writing class because, you know, someone said that's what you do. So I got in a creative writing class, and I met with this professor who ended up becoming my mentor. And the first thing he said, we had little meetings at the beginning of the semester, and he said, what poets do you read? And I said, read? I don't read poets. I'm a poet. I write. He goes, you're an idiot. I go, well, what do you mean? I mean, I'm writing poetry. He goes, you can't write anything until you start reading. So he drew up a list of things that I really hadn't read books before that much. I'd read, as I still tell my students, I'd read 2.5 books that I remember in my school years. One was called Yellow Eyes, and it was about a mountain lion. The other one was The Day Lincoln Was Shot, and it was part of the reading. And I read half of Mysterious Island and got bored. So that was it until I ran into this guy, and then he says, well, who are you reading? I was listening to Bob Dylan over and over and over and over, and the Beatles and so forth, but I really couldn't name poets. I mean, I hadn't really read or studied Shakespeare or any of that kind of stuff. So he drew up a list, and I had to start reading. Well, my book collection started growing at that point. Now it's like probably all of yours. It's insane. My wife knows that. I mean, now I just kind of pitch them in a box and take them to the used bookstore and say, I don't want any money. Just give them a humane death, type thing, because there's too many. And but at that time, I remembered my little library. I had this little shelf in my room that my grandfather had put up there. And it was, maybe that big. And it was starting to fill up with these books. That was my entire collection at that point. And they were Shakespeare and, some of the Dylan Thomas and some of the stuff that he had written that was essential to start to read. Well, he was right, of course. My poetry did start to get more dimension to it and so forth. Now, as that's moving, is this interesting?
Oh, great. Are you sure? Great. Absolutely.
Okay, I don't want to bore you.
You bet. Nope, I'm not bored.
Okay. So as the time starts going on with this, I meet, and this is a community college. That's why I have such great respect for community colleges, because the one I went to was the greatest. And now, I'll show you how great it is. A guy who we used to go to the protest with, he was a professor in political science. He was always getting his head knocked in, arrested. He was, the head of the SDS when he was in college and so forth. He's the president now of the school. And we put poetry things on together, big poetry things, poetry festivals and stuff. So that's another little story. But he was, he always had the army sack over his and the green army coat for the protests, And now he's the freaking president of this college. But we had this wonderful English department and staff. This poet was there. We had two major artists. And the poetry people, the English department, they were friends with a lot of the counterculture people. Mm-hmm. So we had readings at the time. I mean, we didn't quite understand it, but Allen Ginsberg read there, Ed Sanders read there. Bukowski used to come all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he had a good friend in Detroit. And in those days, this is before, most people hadn't heard of him. I mean, Black Sparrow was with him, but now he's a big cult hero. But back then, nobody had really heard of him much. And but we were into him because these teachers turned us on to his stuff. And he would come to this college at that time for a plane ticket, a place to stay, and all the booze he could drink.
Yes.
That's all he wanted. I mean, forget the honorarium. It wasn't that. It was just... And he'd come, and he came a few times, and he would do these readings, and you guys probably have seen them too. Well, you're too young, but you probably have seen them. Have you ever seen them? He did these readings that were just so intense, and here we are, we're like 18, going, holy crap, man, wow. Because I remember one poem, I always remember, and I thought, whatever that moment is in the poetry, I want to get to that in my own writing. That can, and he said, he just looked up at everybody and goes, you want to know what love is, kids? We're not, he goes, it's sleeping with a woman after you piss the bed. And I thought, wow. Wow. I don't know if I want to do that, but wow. And there was something deep in that, It was like, whoa. And that, then he read some poem about something about that. written out here in L.A., which I could have never imagined ever seeing in my lifetime.
Yes.
So then that was part of it, too. Wow, what's that like, where this guy lives and the post office and all the stuff he writes about and so forth. But we were able to get that kind of experience, and also John Cage came and did residency.